This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is It Was a Thing on TV.
Spoiler number one is Dr. Lee Franz. It stinks.
What is going on? What is going on?
Due to some subject matter in this episode, listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the It Was a Thing on TV podcast, episode 18, submission 145, first night 2013. It aired on KDOC television in Los Angeles and KQCA TV in Sacramento on December 31st, 2012.
This is the It Was a Thing on TV podcast. Alongside Mike Klaus and Greg Diener, my name is Chico Alexander, and it is the end of the year, and of course we have a very special year-end celebration, which we're going to go to right after we're done here. Because this what we're about to talk about right now is... It's special, but perhaps not in the way you're thinking of.
No.
It's definitely special.
Yeah, so there's got to be a story about why Jamie Kennedy of all... Well, first of all, I should mention that we're all in our refined tuxes because A, it's New Year's Eve, and B... We're gathered today to mourn the death of Jamie Kennedy's career.
He had one?
Oh, that happened a long time before 2012.
Oh, yeah, that happened after he did Son of the Mask.
That's true.
Well, let me tell you the story about first night 2013 with Jamie Kennedy. So, obviously, we know Jamie Kennedy. He was a famous actor / comedian?
Well, he was famous. He was famous for
a week or two for the Jamie Kennedy experiment.
Yeah.
This was back when the WB... Back when the CW was the WB and there was no such thing as the Arrowverse, so...
Yeah. Maybe this will be featured in... Maybe this will be like a warning thing in the next part of Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Oh, boy.
Well, Jamie Kennedy suggested the idea of hosting a New Year special on LA station KDOC-TV in November 2012 while watching the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade with a friend from the station. Following Thanksgiving, he quickly used the final weeks of the year to attract sponsors and guests for the program, such as the restaurant chain Carl's Jr., which served as the primary sponsor. In planning the special, Kennedy was influenced by the style of Jerry Lewis's MDA Telethon, promising a broadcast which would be fun and spontaneous, and leave viewers guessing what would happen next. He intended First Night to be an anti-New Year's Eve show, with an informal block party atmosphere, held at what he considered to be Hollywood's apex of craziness, Hollywood Boulevard in front of Grumman's Chinese Theater.
And there's absolutely no way you could tell that Carl's Jr. was a primary sponsor of this. None whatsoever.
Oh, no. This is like Idiocracy. This is like Idiocracy, the joke of Carl's Jr. come to life in this special.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I counted 8 Carl's Jr. ads in the broadcast. Plus, the star mascot was sort of essentially like the falling crystal ball, except it didn't really fall. They just sort of zoomed in on it at midnight. But also, one of the of Hugh Hefner's girls, let's say, she was eating one of their turkey jalapeno burgers, which was the big thing they were advertising, in a very provocative way.
I know it was meant to be provocative, but I looked at it and I just thought to myself, this just seems wrong.
Well, there's so much about this that was just wrong. But yeah, there were a ton of Carl's Jr. ads,
And how many times did we see the Pepsi ad with Drew Brees and One Direction? I think that was at least four or five times.
Yeah, I want to say three times with the Drew Brees ending and one time with the One Direction ending. And if I could just say so, Drew Brees and Harry Styles fighting over a Pepsi is peak 2010s.
Hey, guys, I got a question. If Drew Brees and One Direction recorded a gold album together, do you think Drew Brees would get a certificate for reaching gold status?
No.
That's a joke, because Drew Brees got a certificate when he broke the passing yards record a year ago.
You mean a week ago?
No, that's the touchdown record.
Oh, my mistake. I got my records all mixed up.
So, yeah, the show itself. Oh, my God. Oh,
jeez.
We'll go in chronological order. That might be the best way of doing it. Jamie started off with his own monologue, a set of about 6 minutes worth of jokes. And I don't think I heard a single laugh. I mean, even Jay Leno at his worst could get a single laugh. Jamie Kennedy got awkward silence.
Well, that's because Jay Leno has a warm-up guy who is infinitely funnier than he is.
Well, I think, you know, Roadkill is infinitely funnier than Jay Leno.
Like, I'd like to remind everybody, Jay Leno is the reason why Gabrielle Union was fired from America's Got Talent.
Oh, no. I'm gonna have to add that to the FAQ, won't I?
Yes, you will.
Yeah, Jay Leno is the reason Gabrielle Union got fired from America's Got Talent. Well, Jamie Kennedy opens with some very 2012 jokes about the 99% Mitt Romney and the 47% tape. Yeah, guys, remember back in the day where a Republican candidate for president would say a gaffe and he'd actually get in trouble for it?
Yeah, you mean the time before 2016?
Yes.
Okay, I remember it.
Yeah, there was life before 2016, folks.
And of course, the last percentage, the 8% score of Jamie Kennedy's last film on Rotten Tomatoes.
Which is 8% too high.
Give me a second. I want to see what this film is.
Well, I guarantee you Armand White loved the hell out of that movie Jamie Kennedy did. Another very 2012 joke.
Yep, all of our jokes are old this week. Sorry.
There's also a joke he makes about Psy regarding how the packaging of a fortune cookie would no longer be the only thing people think about when they hear the words Asian rapper.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
And again, Psy is so 2012.
Yep. And then you know you're getting in trouble when the special starts to begin to get played with technical problems throughout the night, such as a camera shot of Jamie Kennedy lingering on stage being shown at the beginning of an interview with Shane Elizabeth by the co-host Stu Stone.
Who?
Stu Stone.
All I could find on him is he's one of Jamie Kennedy's friends.
Now, the other co-host Jamie Kennedy had was a lady by the name of Jesse Cruikshank, which Jamie Kennedy co-hosted Future Installment. Oh, sit.
There's just so many D-list celebrities on this special, even D-list for 2012.
Where's my dad to comment about this?
Oh, boy.
He's busy trying to get the slow boat rides installed at Citi Field. Yeah, there just was not much going on. Even the interviews were boring. We'll get to my favorite a little bit later.
Well, but hold up, because we got to mention, who is Jesse Cruikshank interviewing in her first segment?
Drake. Nine-time Kids' Choice winner, Drake Bell.
Who goes on to play Timmy Turner in a live-action version of The Fairly Odd Parents.
Yep.
which means that Butch Hartman now is in the First Knight 2013 universe.
No. Don't go dragging the good name of Butch Hartman into us. Oh, by the way, the last film that Jamie Kennedy did before First Knight 2013 that had a tomato meter score, Tyler Perry's Good Deeds, which is certified 34% fresh.
Are you implying that Jamie Kennedy did other movies that didn't register a Rotten Tomatoes score?
Correct.
Oh, jeez.
If they did, it probably would be close to the 8% he was looking for.
Oh, my.
And now we get to a segment with Stu Stone interviewing professional wrestler Adam Pearce playing poker. Now, Adam Pearce is probably a name that you do not know, per se, but he was a professional wrestler on the show on KDOC TV called Championship Wrestling from Hollywood. I'll go into in-depth on that later on in one particular segment, but he was a wrestler that would be familiar to most of the audience that would be watching KDOC and is now actually currently a producer with the WWE on their NXT show on USA Network.
Right.
And now we get into mentioned first segment, plugging the Commerce Casino in Los Angeles. Now, you guys have been to this casino.
Yes, we have. It's a really good casino. I love the Commerce Casino. It's great atmosphere, great tables, lots of action. You know, if you're in Los Angeles, that's the place to go. That and the bike.
And good friend Joe Van Ginkle works there.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Him too. And interestingly enough, special shout out to my partner on another podcast, Gordon Pepper.
Oh, no. No, I know what you're going to say. Just get it out of your system.
Okay. So we're at the Commerce Casino.
This is about Gordon, 15, mind you, this is this, about 15 years
this
ago.
This is about 15 years ago. Gordon Pepper, Mike, and myself, we're at the Commerce Casino.
Among others.
And we were at the Pike Out tables, and he just kept hitting hand after hand after hand, and everybody at the table was hitting hand after hand after hand, and this little old lovely Asian lady turns to Gordon and says, "You're going to be my lucky white boy."
Oh, and,
you know what? It is still the funniest thing to come out of the Commerce Casino because, well, Jamie Kennedy, you know, funny.
And well, it was such a spur of the moment thing. It was so hilarious. And all of us were laughing. Chico, me. I think the other one who wasn't was Gordon because I think he was in shock he got that nickname.
Oh, yeah. He's stuck with that for life, but he's embraced it.
Yeah. Well, I also want to mention the Commerce Casino, of course, would be used to great fame 4 years later when David Lynch used it for Twin Peaks The Return as the Silver Mustang Casino, which, of course, whenever you think of that casino, always think of First Knight 2013 with Jamie Kennedy and the time Dougie Jones hit 30 mega jackpots at the casino and helped Myrtle from Superstore win a mega jackpot.
What year is it?
But, well, I can say it's certainly not 2012 or 2013, but... So, in this sketch here, we have, like, Jamie Kennedy trying to pitch, like, a mascot for the casino.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
And we have a segment where, in the commercial, where I guess he interrupts somebody while he's in the bathroom.
Oh, God.
I don't know what it's implying. Is it implying that he's going to do a Larry Craig on the guy in the bathroom?
Jeez, oh, Larry Craig.
Good night. Anyway.
But the person he's pitching the idea, I guess the guy, the casino owner, is a guy by the name of David Marquez. Now, David Marquez is not somebody who you, Mike, or no, but professional wrestling fans would know as the producer and interviewer on the show on KDOC that I mentioned, Championship Wrestling from Hollywood. And now David Marquez is currently the interviewer for the YouTube show NWA Power, which airs every Tuesday on YouTube and Facebook Live. And, of course, produced by Billy Corgan. Yeah, Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins now has a wrestling show on YouTube.
Wow. It's like the 90s came back and just hit me in the face with it.
Yes.
Yeah, this just wasn't funny. Just because of all the situations he pops up in. And also it gets a little racist at some points.
It gets incredibly racist at some point.
Okay, maybe I underestimated the racism factor, but and that's like a common theme throughout this whole special is just like ODing on like racism, blatant racism. There's one scene where this mascot goes to a table. I want to say it was probably Haigao or Baccarat or something like that. And he says something in Korean to a table full of Asian players. And one of the players...
This was during the heist sketch.
Yeah. And one of the players says, we don't speak Asian. We're from Sherman Oaks. It's like, again, just another baffling thing. Oh, it gets worse, though. It gets worse.
So much worse.
And now we get to the next part of the show, which is Jesse Cruikshank interviewing Olympic gold medalist Dawn Harper. And I believe, Chico, you have some information on Dawn Harper.
Yeah, I believe I do. She won Olympic gold in London and Olympic silver in Beijing. And I believe she was just wearing all of those medals while she was in the interview with Jesse. And I'm looking at, again, Truth by Consensus Wikipedia. And, yeah, gold in Beijing and silver in London. And she swears she woke up with those medals draped around her neck.
And now we get into another skit where Jamie's doing like long jump and track and field, and it's terrible.
Yeah, so he was on site, on location with Allison Felix, another Olympic medalist, and they're talking about her regimen and the preparation for participating in the Olympics or athletic events. But this also included one of the few times that I actually laughed throughout this entire special. Allison Felix originally said to him, "Aren't you Andy Dick?" No. Oh, you're Tom Green. No. Oh, you're Seth Green. And he makes an offhand comment. If I was Seth Green, I'd be as tall as my male body part. Let's just say that. Yeah. And that was the funniest thing. Just her, one of the two funniest things in this was her saying that about him, and he was just like goofing around. He was wearing really short shorts, which left a little to the imagination. But it was just again something that was really not funny, and it's just again uncomfortable to say the least. And then actually he tried giving her some of his awards because he did win like a Blockbuster Award back in, I think, 2007 or 2008. And he tried giving that to her. And, oh, well, they don't make these anymore because Blockbuster Awards were dead. And then he actually tried giving her a flask, which was a promotional gift for some TV series that either he did or he partnered up with. Just, again, stupid.
So you're trying to tell me, Mike, that there's a possibility we might have OSIT flasks?
No, it wasn't OSIT, I can tell you that. It wasn't Oset, but you know, if you wanted to watch Oset, you need a drink out of a flask.
Well, hold up. Do you think it, one of those Jamie Kennedy flasks was what the old man from Mystery Diners was drinking? So now we go back to Stu, who's talking about something right behind the Carl's Jr. mascot.
Because why not?
Because why not?
So after this interview by Stu with the Carl's Jr. mascot behind him, it was thrown to Bridget Marquardt, who was inside a nightclub of some sort. And this is one of those things that left all of us a little uncomfortable. After a commercial break, you had Jamie Cruikshank backstage at this club with Bridget, and she had her eat a Carl's Jr. turkey jalapeno burger, which is what they were pushing. And she
because there was a Carl's Jr. food truck as well.
Oh, there's Carl's Jr. everywhere. And so she had to eat the sandwich in as provocative of a way as possible. Not unlike the TV ads you would have seen around that time with the female washing the car and getting all soapy and eating a Carl's Jr. burger.
And the best part is Jesse saying after Bridget eats the burger, "I'm a vegetarian and I'm very aroused."
I bet you are.
Well, good for you.
And then the best part is Jesse is trying to cut it back to Jamie, and then you can clearly see Stu Stone on camera like, it's like, it's actually me, Stu Stone, not Jamie.
Yeah.
And that was thrown to another skit. It was skit that took part at the Laugh Factory, which is kind of ironic because Jamie Kennedy doesn't produce laughs. Did either of you see that and have anything to add about that? I did skip over this.
Well, no, because I was too distracted by that kid wearing the Angry Birds hat to even watch it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's 2012, so, yeah, everybody had Angry Birds gear.
Yeah, I couldn't follow. I was like, as far as I know, it was just a thing at the Laugh Factory, and yeah.
But then really, and I think this is almost like the surreal part of the night. This is a New Year's Eve gathering, a festive, you know, supposedly fun time. Just let's say it is for all intents and purposes. And then it goes back to Stu. And who is Stu interviewing? This very beautiful, buxom lady named Anna Rosales. So what do you think Stu and Anna Rosales are going to talk about? 2013, you know, what are you drinking tonight? How are you celebrating? No.
They talked about California's green initiatives.
Yeah, they talked about energy efficiency in your house. Is that not like the perfect topic you want to talk about on New Year's Eve? Hey, we're having fun partying, listening to music, dancing, drinking. Do you want to talk about the green initiative as to how we can cut down the bills in our household energy usage?
I think that had something to do with going hand in hand with you know, sponsors and stuff.
There were some ads for some green stuff in there, but it just seems so out of place. I mean, I know I get it with all the advertising for Carl's Jr. and the other advertising, but again, you're putting in basically a PSA, a public service announcement about how to lower your heating bills in your house. What does that have to do with New Year's Eve? Nada.
Nada.
And the best part about this is that woman in the background mocking Stu Stone, lip syncing to every dumb thing he says.
Yes. Oh, that's the great takeaway. Not just this totally off topic conversation about greenhouse efficiency, but there's a person behind Stu's right hand shoulder, and she's just mocking everything he says.
As if he totally doesn't notice him.
Oh yeah, he's totally oblivious to all this. And then we get to our first musical guest.
Oh boy.
That's one way of saying it. Macy Gray.
You mind if I just cut to the chase here?
Cut to the chase, please.
Yeah, she didn't wait till midnight to break open the bubbly, I don't think.
Oh no, she was getting imbibed beforehand.
To quote your name, if she was struggling.
Yep.
To say the least. This actually took us right to just about midnight.
Yes.
Yeah, Macy Gray was still on the stage till just about 11:59, but then, like, of all the reasons that you're there, they screwed up the biggest one. You're there to celebrate midnight. So how do they screw up? They started the countdown, 15-second countdown, at 11:59 and 55 seconds.
Whoops.
So when they hit zero, it was already midnight, 10 seconds after midnight. The one job. You had one job.
I got one question. Do you think Tom Poston was distracting David Marquez in the control room?
Oh, jeez.
What, David? Wait, what do you mean, David? Well, the countdown's coming. Oh, my God. Oh, go the countdown.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, heavens.
Yeah, so Macy Gray had to stop her performance halfway because it was so close to midnight, A. And B, she was just gone. G-O-N, gone.
G-O-N, gone. Okay, that must be that North Carolina spelling. Go Tar Heels.
I don't even know. What she was singing, but she sort of ended the set with an a cappella rendition of I Try, which...
She didn't. Sorry. She didn't.
Like I said, let's say, made Mariah Carey's New Year's performances in the past look like a masterclass.
Okay, so after the botched countdown, we have Stu Stone interviewing a bunch of the festive people in the crowd, and we go into our best segment of the show. Mike, you want to take it from here?
If I have to.
Go ahead, Mike.
So Stu was interviewing, again, just random people, or we'd assume random people, celebrating. And he goes to this guy who looks like he's probably in his early 20s, and says, what's your name? And the kid says, kid in a relative sense, says, my name's Taylor M. Effing, and that's all I heard. And, whoa, we can't say that. Whoa, yeah. And then Stu turns around to the person on his right-hand side and says, and what's your name? And this woman, who doesn't look much older than him, we're talking about the Taylor who said, you know, Taylor MFing whatever. She says, I'm his mother.
So proud.
Well, the thing is, if you look at her, I really doubt he's her mother. I mean, maybe older sister, but I really don't think, I don't think she was his mother. Regardless, that was just great comedic timing. And who are you? I'm his mother.
Oh, boy. And then we get into a taped message from Chris Angel congratulating Jamie on a very happy new year, which makes sense because, in my opinion, Fire Special is a mind freak. Get it? That's a pun because he had a
We got it.
And now we get into the second musical group of the night, Bone Thugs and Harmony.
The pride of Cleveland.
Indeed.
Yeah, Mike, this is your people here.
They actually are from the suburb that I lived in, the little suburb. So I didn't necessarily know them, but they're They're from my hood, if you will.
Oh, you down for their cause then?
I know about Bone Thugs.
I then.
And we have more F bombs during their musical segment. Whoever was on the 5-second delay was very asleep at the wheel. But I mean, we already said Tom Poston already botched the countdown, so it's not surprising.
Oh, Tom Poston was the censor person? I missed it again. Well, then after that, after Bone Thugs and Harmony did their bit and there were some more ads, get to maybe the most offensive skit of the night.
Okay, so...
And just from the outset, it is offensive.
Yeah.
The first frame of the skit is offensive.
Yeah, all you need to know is Jamie Kennedy in, I guess you could call it, red face in a boardroom.
And a typical Indian headdress.
In a boardroom filled with like-minded comedians? Also in red face.
And the sort of ironic part is they're not portraying Native Americans.
They're portraying Mayans.
They're portraying Mayans because if you remember...
Who are also Natives.
Yeah, well, yeah, but not in the American sense. But if you remember 2012, the Mayans, the end of their calendar was December 21st of 2012. And so the world's going to end then.
Tell you what, Mike, after watching this skit, I wish the world had ended 10 days earlier.
Yeah, this was bad. Yeah. So what the whole premise of the skit was is Jamie Kennedy was a Mayan leader, and he wanted to regain his, I don't want to say territory, but his money. And the way he did it was by playing in a poker tournament.
Where was the poker tournament, Mike?
Oh, would you believe it was at the Commerce Casino?
No! I am shocked.
That's also one other thing we should add is after each of these skits was an ad for the LA Poker Classic at the Commerce Casino. So it's just like one. It isn't comedy. It's three giant long ads for the poker tournament, the LA Poker Classic, at the Commerce Casino. This is like a 90-minute or 2-hour-long infomercial for Carl's Jr. and the Commerce Casino.
You know, and now the Garda Heart Foundation, which still operates.
But I will add one thing. There was one great line in that skit.
What was it?
Since you asked, here it is.
Maybe we should just go back to predictions. Does anyone have any? Anyone?
Yes, sir. Prediction coming. I predict that comedian Jamie Kennedy will never work again after this skit.
You know, that was great. Jamie Kennedy will never work again after this skit. And almost true to life, he didn't work again. Or not necessarily didn't work again. But yeah, you haven't heard from him in years.
Well, unless you're a fan of Funny You Should Ask, in which case, well, he was on the Funny You Should Ask with a whole lot of other, I guess, what Byron Allen considers comedians. So,
and since we're talking about Funny You Should Ask, hey Tim, hey Adam, hey Jay Keith,
you know, guys, I don't understand why Jamie Kennedy as a Mayan wanted to get his money back in a poker game. He should have just found Dougie Jones so he could hit the mega jackpots. Dougie Jones is going around like, oh, Dougie Jones, can you show me where I can get the money back for wasting my money on the end of the world? Call for help.
Oh, boy.
And now we get another Happy New Year interstitial from Mario Andretti, which makes sense. Because after watching this special, I want to do 100 miles an hour and crash into a wall and die.
Oh, jeez!
Oh, God. You know, in the spirit of this episode, bleep that! Bleep that!
Oh, that's horrible.
That is horrible, and you should be ashamed of yourself, Greg.
After that, we went back to Bridget Marquardt, and there was some sort of, like, sky dancer who came through the ceiling, and I didn't get that.
It was supposed to be some sort of Vegas-style aerialist show bringing down the booze for New Year's. It was pretty cool-looking, but didn't really do much. All she did was hang on those ribbons, and she just hung on ribbons and held a bottle of champagne. That's it.
So after Bridget Marquardt was in the theater or the nightclub with that aerialist, Stu Stone interviewed Busy Bone from Bone Thugs and Harmony. Nothing really crazy happened there. Just a little promotion for their new record. And what are you going to do for the new year? Oh, health, wealth, and happiness and love and stuff like that.
Which is understandable.
Which is very, yes.
Because we all need a little love.
Health, wealth, and happiness. That's all I ask for.
We need a little Busy Bone in our life.
Yes, we do.
After the commercial, there were holiday wishes or New Year's wishes from Tony Hawk. But then we get another PSA thrown in the middle of this celebration. Right, Chico?
Yeah, it's for the Garda Heart Foundation, which is doing great things to still doing great things to sort of advocate for heart health in the Southern California community. Although, like, the whole Green Initiatives thing just seems out of place. But then again, their name was on the step and repeat, so I'm guessing they, too, did a little bit of a sponsor hit, so there you go. So to review, Carl's Jr., the Commerce Casino, and the Garda Heart Foundation.
And don't forget Pepsi with Drew Brees and One and Direction.
Pepsi with Drew Brees in One Direction. That is peak 2010s.
Yes. Peak early 2010s.
The band that followed the PSA for the Heart Foundation was TTK, whoever they are. And then after that,
we have a third skit for the Commerce Casino in the LA Poker Classic.
What? Another skit?
Another one?
Yeah, but this one was sort of like Ocean's 11. Wouldn't you agree, Greg?
Yes, it's like Jamie and Stu, and I think they're trying to get into the break into the poker tournament.
Because, of course, they are.
Yeah. And then there's a third member of their entourage. I don't know what her name is, so I'm just going to call her Tits McGee because look at her. Anyway,
guys, he said it, not me. So don't.
Yeah, that's me. All on Chico. And of course, this was another advertisement for the LA Poker Classic, January 15th to March 3rd, 2013, at the Commerce Casino.
Get your tickets now.
Yeah, so they went back to TTK, and they weren't even introduced. They just started playing music. So after TTK finished playing their set, Greg, there's a message from whom?
Well, we got a New Year's wish from Soulja Boy. Because remember Soulja Boy?
Yeah, he was a thing for a minute.
Yeah, a thing for a hot minute. Apparently he was still around and late 2012, early 2013, and he wishes us a happy new year. Well, Soulja Boy, in about 5 or 6 years, you're going to be selling crappy Chinese bootleg game consoles, so.
What?
You don't know that, Chico, that he sold crappy Chinese bootleg game consoles?
I did not know that.
That was like the big hot thing on gaming YouTube like a year or two ago.
I did not know that.
Oh my god, yeah. He was selling them on, like, what the heck, AliExpress or whatever.
Oh boy.
Well, yeah, like Alibaba or something like that?
Yeah.
Now it makes sense. Anyway.
Well, and now we get to the part, Mike, where when I first showed you this special, you said, this is as far as I got.
No. What happened is when you first showed me this, I just like fast-forwarded to near the end, and I happened upon this, and the timing was very awkward, to say the least. It's a skit with Jamie Kennedy and some of Jim Henson's puppet creations. Not Muppets, but some of the puppet creations that you've seen over the last, say, 10 to 15 years in shows like Late Night Liars, Future Induction, and That Puppet Game Show, Future Induction, and No, You Shut Up. Guess what? Future Induction.
Future Induction.
Yes. And I recognize some of these creatures immediately. It looks like the weasel's in one of the characters in this. If you remember the weasel from Late Night Liars.
I do remember the weasel from Late Night Liars.
And then also another puppet that was featured in this skit was, and this is her description from No, You Shut Up. She is a lesbian leopard, or at least was on No, You Shut Up.
She was all over Jamie in that sketch.
Yeah, well, not saying a word. And then there was a goat which showed up in both No, You Shut Up and also That Puppet Game Show. So this segment with all these Jim Henson puppets and Jamie Kennedy was about the topic of the inappropriate topic of rape.
Well, where was Todd Akin when you needed him?
Oh, God, that joke was sold. It's an antique.
Well, it was 2012, so it was very timely at the time.
Yeah.
So, as I was saying, I had the unfortunate luck while fast-forwarding through this to land at the precise point where one of the puppets offers to give oral sex to Jamie Kennedy.
Oh, God.
That blows.
No. Oh. Fine. That was horrible. That was horrible.
But yeah.
I'm groaning. I'm groaning, and I just did a Todd Akin joke like 30 seconds ago.
Chico, would you like to add your own nasty joke right now?
I will I'll plead the fifth.
And you'll drink the fifth too.
I'll plead the fifth of Jack on this.
Thankfully, this is the last skit. Before we get to the grand ending, there's one more thing that Greg wants to add, which really wasn't in the video we saw. It was sort of in a supplemental video, sort of like the stuff that really shouldn't have made it to air but did. And Greg, if you'd like to speak about that.
Yeah, near the end of the special, Jamie Kennedy interviews a pair of African-American women on stage. One of the women on stage claimed that her New Year's resolution was to get rid of all my haters, quote unquote, and quipped to one of them going white instead of black would keep her, according to Jamie Kennedy, and I don't want to say that. Keep her V very tight.
Keep her cooter very tight.
Yeah, and then Jamie Kennedy, and the V is not bleeped, by the way. And Jamie Kennedy's on stage going, bleep that, jumping up and down. I'm sorry, Jamie, but once again, Tom Poston is asleep at the wheel.
Oh, jeez. Well, they had a skit celebrating the decades, 1890s, 1920s. 1950s and the 1990s, and compared to everything else, it was lame by comparison. It was very very tame by comparison, I should say. Not lame, tame.
Yeah, to the rest of the show. That's probably the least offensive thing on the night.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then after that skit, we had the closing thanks. Everybody was on stage that apparently had something to do with this. And it was sort of reminiscent of what you'd see on Saturday Night Live, where you'd have the guest host and the musical guest and the cast, and any special guests that were there, and they'd all be hugging and like celebrating and you know, thanking the audience in the closing credits. Except the big difference here is there must have been probably 40 to 50 people on stage for really a stage that looks like it was built for no more than about 10 people. So given that there was a lack of room, tempers flared up, you know, because people were pushing and shoving, and we went to the end credits with a full-out brawl. What says New Year's besides fist fighting? This almost seems like an appropriate ending, given how much of a mess this was.
But it's not, you see, because I want to say it was a day or two after Stu Stone goes on the air with Stryker of the world famous K-Rock, K-R-O-Q, in Los Angeles. And he actually goes on to defend this piece of crap.
Well, it's very interesting how this came to light. Following the broadcast, the footage was posted on YouTube, and the person who really made it viral, of all things, was comedian extraordinaire Patton Oswalt.
Who is incredibly funny, by the way.
Exactly. I mean, he is superbly hilarious. He's done some great movies. One that he did, I think it's been at least 10, 12 years ago at this point, which I think is one of his best performances, is in a movie called Big Fan.
I remember that movie. It's a good movie.
Oh, it's a very good movie, and he did a real good job in it. So Patton Oswalt found this footage, posted it on Twitter. It went viral quickly, and a number of media outlets and blogs picked it up. From a critical perspective, the AV Club's Nathan Rabin, who actually called the special the Jamie Kennedy Falling Apart at the Seams New Year's Eve 2013 Spectacular, which is not untrue. That's definitely a good alternative title. Supported Kennedy's assertion that First Night was an antithesis to other similar specials, suggesting that if Dick Clark is the trusted authority figure who made sure everything went swimmingly, Kennedy is more like the creepy uncle whose idea of discipline and order is making the 15-year-olds he hangs out with promise they'll get good and drunk before playing with the illegal fireworks he bought them. Seems about right.
Yeah.
And then Rabin also criticized Kennedy's open monologue for potentially being anti-comedy or just bad material. Again, I didn't hear a single laugh, so that shows how funny it was, or lack of.
They were laughing on the inside, Mike.
I was not laughing, period.
I wasn't laughing. I was like, let me just get to the end of this.
Yeah, it was painful. Jamie Kennedy's confrontational attitude towards the audience throughout the show. And Jesse Cruikshank was critiqued for her over-the-top recognition of Drake Bell's 9 Kids' Choice Awards.
9 Kids' Choice Awards!
Did you know that Drake Bell has 9 Nickelodeon Kids' Choice Awards?
I do now.
Hey, it's a very prestigious award, Mike.
It's prestigious in the preteen set, I get it.
How many times do you get an award that's shaped like a blimp? How many awards can you think of? Not many.
Maybe there's a Goodyear blimp prize, I don't know. Maybe this special should get a blimp award. The Humanity Award.
I wonder what Drake Bell's doing now.
Just like everybody on this, we haven't heard from him since 2013. But also the interviews with Don Harper and Bridget Marquardt, he felt were clearly a setup for a plug for Carl's Jr. No, really? With Bridget Marquardt holding onto that burger, you think that was a plug for Carl Jr.? I'm shocked.
Hang on, guys. Did we ever talk about the interview that Stu Stone did with Shannon?
I don't think we did.
No, yeah, we didn't talk about that. Yeah, we had this awkward thing like near the beginning of the show where. Where they cut to Stu Stone interviewing Shannon Elizabeth, while Jamie Kennedy is like still in the shot, just like on the stage doing like, I don't know, he's like futzing around or something.
But yeah, it's like somebody clearly forgot their cue.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, going back to Tom Post and running the board. Yeah, this was just like full of just technical mishaps and vulgarities which got by the censors, and surely the FCC heard about it. Thankfully, it was only shown on two stations. But also, again, the critic, Mr. Rabin of the AV Club, mentioned Jamie Kennedy, his casino sketch, specifically the one that was quote-unquote racist in its grotesque minstrelsy of Native American culture and not funny, which we all said it was more offensive than anything else. None of this was really funny. He also felt that Macy Gray's performance was shambling yet strangely majestic, speculating that she and the rest of the production staff may have been drunk. Again, no. Shocker.
Wow.
And felt that the performance by Bonestuck and Harmony would have been a muddy, dispiriting dirge, even without a backing track. Rabin did praise the special for its unexpectedly surreal nature. Okay, if you want to call that praiseworthy, sure. Considering it the least professional and most entertaining New Year's Eve broadcast I have ever seen. In a later article in December 2013, the AV Club named Jamie Kennedy as one of eight pretenders to Dick Clark's New Year's Eve throne, remarking that in comparison to the other seven personalities listed, few hosts, though, have matched Jamie Kennedy's spectacular failure on the Orange County station KDOC last year, and concluded that, as Auld Lang Syne played over on ABC, Kennedy reminded the world that some old acquaintances really should be forgot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was... Well, you could tell it was hurried from the get-go, because as we mentioned at the beginning, Jamie Kennedy got this idea from watching the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. So that means he would have had 5 weeks, give or take, to get this set up. Yeah, maybe five and a half weeks. So it's not like he had 6 months or a year to prepare, like, say, ABC would with Dick Clark's New Year's Eve, or CNN with what Anderson Cooper and Kathy Griffin do, or Fox with Steve Harvey. This was really just, like, thrown together at the last minute, very haphazardly, and it really showed.
It's basically, A, friends of Jamie Kennedy, and B, who can we get at the last possible second?
Yeah, who's available on New Year's Eve that was still available on December 10th? And really, that's what it seems like. Okay, let's find any celebrities we can. And as I said, like, everybody on this show was already like a D-list celebrity in 2012.
Oh, yeah, you also have the wrestling personalities that were on KDOC in Adam Pearce and David Marquez. So, and to Chico's point, it was basically, let's get anybody we could find and put them on this special.
Yeah, it was haphazardly thrown together. And it just looked highly unprofessional. I mean, not just from the constant technical mistakes and the vulgarities that got out over the air, but I mean, the one job you had to do was the countdown, and you flubbed that up. You flubbed the countdown.
Oh, how of all things, a New Year's Eve special is all about the countdown. How do you mess that up? Well, there's a reason why they don't give the West Coast New Year's Eve specials. Well, guys, what do you think? First night 2013 with Jamie Kennedy. It was certainly a thing on TV.
I mean, it was a certain thing on certain TVs in California at the very least, but thank you, Internet. Thank you, YouTube, for letting everybody see how bad this is.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Be
Place to Be Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the It Was a Thing on TV podcast, episode 19, submission 266, Super Jeopardy and Monopoly. Super Jeopardy aired on ABC from June 16th to September 8th of 1990 for a total of 13 episodes. As always, Greg is here, Chico's here, I'm Mike, and we're going to cover two game shows today. And the reason we're covering these two shows is because coming up starting on this Tuesday, the 7th of January, ABC is doing a greatest of all time tournament involving Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter and James Holzhauer. And maybe some of our listeners don't know that this isn't the first time ABC tried this with Jeopardy. 30 summers ago, I should say, there was a 13-week tournament where many of the big winners of the previous, that would be about six seasons up to that point. Yeah, it was summer of 1990, so that was about six seasons. They all competed in this tournament, as well as one other person who did not win between 1984 and 1990. We'll get to that in a moment. And the winner of the tournament took home
$250,000. $250,000 in 1990 money, folks.
Yeah, which would be at least half a million now, if not even closer to maybe $600,000 or $700,000. This tournament, while it was meant to be a draw of all the former champions, I think the one thing that really hurt this show was it aired on a Saturday night. This is Saturday Night Filler back in 1990. This wasn't something you'd see on a Friday night or a Thursday night or a Monday night right after the Jeopardy show airs in your area. No, no, no. This is a Saturday night thing. And typically Saturday night is not the best night for ratings.
Especially Saturday nights in the summer.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And there's nothing really special about this Jeopardy. It was the same questions and answers you're used to. There are some minor differences, though. First is there were no dollars. It was all for points. And whoever had the most points in an episode obviously won and played the next week or played in the next tier of games. And another thing is, and this sort of predates the actual show Jeopardy by about 11 years, kind of, sort of. The values in single Jeopardy were doubled. They were the 200, 400, 600, 800, 1,000 that we've been used to for the last going on two decades.
Yeah, but then in the double Jeopardy round, it didn't necessarily double. They just got bumped up to 500, 1,000. 1,500, 2,000, and 2,500.
It was the double and a half Jeopardy round. But also the other really big thing about Super Jeopardy, it's the first time it's happened, at least in the United States. There were four-person games.
Yep.
Now, that made me actually wonder, did they build a fourth podium specifically for this event, or do they keep an extra podium backstage in case one breaks down? And I'm going to ask, I'm going to pose it to Chico, since he's been on the show. Maybe he has more insight than I do. Do they only have the three podiums? And I realize that 2018 is a little different than 1990, but is there a backup podium in case the electronics go bad?
No, if the electronics go bad, we get index cards.
Which, yeah, you do see every now and then, not very often, but you do see index cards come into play if the light pins conk out or something. Well, also, if I remember correctly, the current Jeopardy, the lecterns for the contestants is one giant piece.
Yes, it's been one giant piece for, I want to say, what was the first HD season of Jeopardy? Because that's when they moved from three separate pieces to one giant piece.
Well, would this have come with one of the set changes?
No, they actually retrofitted the existing set for the HD lecterns.
Oh.
And then it was the 25th anniversary. Wait a minute, was it the 25th anniversary? It was the 25th anniversary during that when they did the show in Las Vegas for CES, when they did the whole set. They built the whole set for CES, and then they trucked it back to LA, and that became the set until a couple of years later when they changed it again.
And actually, I think the first year that it broadcast in HD may have been 2006, because I remember, and I think you were there, Chico, we went to go see the first week of Wheel of Fortune that season, and that was the first episode that was being broadcast in HD.
Yep.
So it definitely wouldn't surprise me if 2006 is the answer to that question. So, as we said, there were 36 contestants, 35 winners from Jeopardy between 1984 and 1990, and one other individual who we'll get to in a moment. Some of the names are just, if you know anything about Jeopardy, especially Jeopardy 30 years ago, 35 years ago, these are like the Ken Jennings and the Brad Rutters and the James Holzhauers of the 80s. Going through the names really quickly, you had Bob Vereni, definite superstar, one of the best. Bruce Negley, another good player. I remember the name from back in the day. Steve Rogitz, Wita Relstab, Frank Spangenberg, who is, I mean, by far, like, one of the best.
Officer Frank, I believe the only player in the pre-double value era to get to 100,000.
In 5 days, I believe you're right, yes.
Yeah, because it was something around 102,000 he had in his run.
Yeah. I've got the stats right here because, well, I do my homework.
He's prepared.
Yes, I am. Hey, do you know the other podcast I do? It's my job to be prepared. But yeah, Frank Spangenberg, over his 5 days on Jeopardy, won a total of 102,597. The winnings were capped at 75,000 per the rules of the show at the time, which means $27,597 were donated to Frank's selected charity, the Missionaries of Charity in New York City.
Yeah, that would have been CBS Network rules, I believe.
Yes.
Yes, because CBS went from 25,000, I think, to maybe 50,000 sometime in the 80s. I remember, I think it was around the time Pressure Luck was on, so that was probably around 85, 86.
No, wrong.
Okay,
I mentioned that I was prepared. Okay, so it was 1988-89, because it was season 6. He was a five-time champion during season 6. So 1989, 1990, one of those two. And again, the cap was 75,000 because the cap was raised to 50,000 during Press Your Luck, and then again to 75,000 until sometime in the last 10 or 15 years when they just said to hell with the cap.
Isn't that what I said? I said the cap was raised to 50,000 when Press Your Luck was on the air, and then it was raised.
Sorry. I you know what? I misunderstood. I'm sorry.
All right, let me explain. Press Your Luck, sometime in late 84, early 85, after Merkel Larson basically robbed the CBS network of 110 grand, decided, you know what? We might as well raise our silly limit from 25,000 to 50,000.
So after Frank Spangenberg, we had Brian Wangsgaard and Eugene Fineman and Kate Waits. In episode 3, we had Elise Boraru, Richard Perez Pena. Here's a name that may ring a bell to a couple of folks. Gary Giardina.
That would ring a bell. That is a bell ringer.
Why does it ring a bell?
Because he was on another show, obviously.
He was on another show, obviously. Which one?
I do not remember.
Oh, you forgot that he was on Future Entry Double Dare? And then the last player in episode 3 was Eric Newhouse, who actually was the 1989 college tournament winner. Good player back in the day.
Very good player back in the day. And, of course, the three winners of those quarterfinals would meet again in the semifinal. Those would be Bob Verini, Eugene Finnerman, and Eric Newhouse.
And then the fourth quarterfinal game, we had Mark Lowenthal, another familiar name, Paul Ruffa, Kathy Boggs, and Keith Walker. In the quarterfinal number 5, we had Rich Lerner, Bruce Seymour, Liz Cassisi, and here's the name of the person who was not a winner on Jeopardy between 1984 and 1990. Burns Cameron.
I remember that guy.
And Chico does. I think he has a story to tell.
Yes, I do. This was this was actually about 15 years ago.
I think it was 14 years ago.
Okay,
yeah.
14, 15 years ago. And we were playing a mock game. It was Burns Cameron, myself, and Maddie Suchard, who would go on to be a Kids Week contestant on Jeopardy. Still doing well, by the way. She says hi. Burns just absolutely mops the floor with the two of us.
But who ended up winning?
Burns Cameron.
No, I thought it was Maddie.
Oh, my bad. Again.
Yeah. Because I think it was faulty wagering, and she had very little money. I mean, mind you, you know, 14 years ago, Maddie Suchard would have been all of about 12 or 13, and she's going against Chico and Burns Cameron, who is like the greatest champ of Jeopardy in the Art Fleming era back in the 60s and 70s. And she ends up winning because she was playing defensively, and everybody got final wrong, and here she wins with whatever, $5 or $10 or whatever. But yeah, it's just very surreal. But also, we should give a plug out for where we did this, or where you did this. This was at the old Game Show Congress, which has sort of morphed into the Trivia Conferences in North America.
Which has sort of morphed into the Trivia Nationals, which is coming up this July.
Yes, by the way, late July, early August.
By the way, happy National Trivia Day.
Yes, today, the day we're taping, January 4th, is National Trivia Day. So it's very timely that we're talking about this. So that was the fifth quarterfinal. Sixth quarterfinal, Tom Cubbage, again, another good player from back in the day, Leah Greenwald, Lionel Goldbart, and Roger Storm. Then you had semifinal game number two, which was Keith Walker versus Bruce Seymour versus Roger Storm. Then we get to the last three quarterfinal games.
And this is, we got two good ones in this ninth game.
Yeah, this is where you hear the big ones.
The first name is the big one, if you ask me. The first name in game seven, Chuck Forrest.
He likes to bounce.
He was the creator of the bounce. He was the first super champion. He was amazing.
If the current Jeopardy rules were in effect, I guarantee you, you'd probably have like a James Holzhauer run.
Oh yeah, he would have easily lasted probably 20, 25, 30 episodes. Then you had Dave Traney, Ron Black, and Yale Sofair. S-O-F-A-E-R. Sofair, Sofair. Quarterfinal eight had Bob Blake. Again, another big name from back in the day. Michael Rankins, friend of a couple of us.
Yep.
Yes. Keith Bell and Peggy Malice.
Yeah.
And I've got a Michael Rankin story. I beat him in Jeopardy this year at Trivia Nationals. Five-man Jeopardy, and I won. So I'm just saying, I beat a Jeopardy champion and a competitor in the Super Jeopardy tournament. I need to just, there you go, pat myself on the back. There we
go. Good job. You want a cookie?
I could use one. I feel so accomplished. And then the last quarterfinal game was Sandy Gore, Jeff Richmond, another name which is sort of familiar online nowadays. He keeps on popping up on my people you may know list, and there's like three dozen of my friends have Jeff Richmond as a mutual friend, so obviously he still gets around. And Bruce Fahlman and Zeke Sevilla Jr. And the third semifinal game ended up being Dave Traney, Bob Blake, and Jeff Richmond. And the winners of the semifinals game who played in the final game were Bob Verini, Bruce Seymour, and Dave Traney. And the big winner, I mean, if you look at those three names, the name that sticks out to me as the person who should win is Bob Verini.
Yes.
But it was Bruce Seymour who won.
Yep, I've got the final right. This was the deciding final. This was the hardest clue in the world in 1990. Here it is. Category is, I feel like I'm doing WLTI all of a sudden. The category is the 20th century, and here's the clue. He was vice president of the U.S. for just 82 days before becoming president.
Hold on.
I already know this.
Hold on. Yeah, give me a second. I'm thinking about it. Oh, I think I got it. Yeah. Okay.
Right,
Greg, reveal. Yeah, go, Greg.
Who is Harry S. Truman?
That's my answer, too. Who's Harry S. Truman?
Yes, it is Harry S. Truman. He was vice president 82 days. And again, this was a, well, this wasn't a lock tournament, but there was really nothing that anybody could do. When Bob lost everything, I mean, he played as well as he could have. But Bruce got it right and won the $250,000. And that was Super Jeopardy.
No, there's one more thing I want to add.
Oh, there was.
There's one more little thing I want to add.
Tell me more, sir.
Super Jeopardy spawned a home version.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I was just watching watching YouTube playthroughs. There were actually two. Home versions, the first one being on the NES and the second one being on the PC. The NES version looked like a downscaled version of the PC version.
The NES version, I've played it with somebody in the recent past, within the last probably 2 or 3 years. It is a slog to get through.
It is.
That's the one downfall to most of the Jeopardy games is... it's going to take you more than half an hour to play it. But this, it took an unusually longer amount of time because it had a voice chip built in, which really for 1990 is pretty cool technology for a home video game. But oh my gosh, I'm not joking. It must have taken probably close to, over an hour, if not closer to about 75 minutes to play one game of Super Jeopardy. And that wasn't a four-person game. It was a three-person game. You could have played four people on that.
Yeah, in fact, it's one of the few it's one of the few NES games that requires four players. So if you had like an NES four score or an NES satellite, and you had like four, three other people around, you could say, "Hey, do you want to play some Super Jeopardy on NES?
You want to waste 2 hours of your life playing Jeopardy?"
I mean, I would. I don't know about the rest.
Well, like I said, as is the case with most Jeopardy games, you had to type in the answer letter by letter. And yeah, if you had like, some long answer, that could take most of the 60 seconds for you to put in the answer. And then you had the computer say, "You're right," or "You're wrong," or whatever. And as much as I love Jeopardy, home games, that's one of the downfalls, except for the Switch version that came out a couple of years ago. Since that's all multiple choice, you can easily play that game in probably about 20 minutes.
I think the 360 PS3 version of Jeopardy from a couple of years ago.
I actually have that. You are correct. It was a bundle pack with Wheel of Fortune. It was called. They called it America's Favorite Game Shows, Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy.
No, that's the PS4 Xbox
One. Oh, my bad.
That's the name of the Switch version, too.
Yeah, I know my Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune versions on consoles, maybe. I was very good at playing Jeopardy Junior Edition back in the day on NES, let me tell you. That's for you, Annie. God bless you.
And also, that's another sort of spoiler for later on this year. We're doing an episode all about video games based on TV shows. Now, we're not going to cover Super Jeopardy, obviously, but we found some doozies. Oh, my.
I'm sure we'll have some NES Game Tech versions in there.
Yeah.
Oh, I guarantee. I know. Just not even thinking about it, I know there's one. I'm not going to say what it is. Actually, we could make a case for two of them, but yeah, there's definitely going to be at least one, but we've compiled a very, it's a bad list. There's some bad games out there. So yeah, the video game show is a little bit away. It'll be in early March, but we'll just tell you right now, Super Jeopardy is not on the list. We covered it right here.
Well, Mike, that was Super Jeopardy. And now we get into the part that we wanted to discuss on this show.
This is the reason we're here, right? And what we're talking about is we're talking about Monopoly, which aired after Super Jeopardy. And it only aired from June 16th to September 1st of 1990. It only had 12 episodes. You just heard part of the theme song of Monopoly, and Chico has a very apt way of describing it.
It is a bop.
Seriously, it's like a throwback to the 50s.
Yeah, and it fits because, let's think about this. When was Monopoly created? It was created in the 30s.
Okay, so. The 50s and 30s is close enough. Yeah, we're never good at mathematics. but also, it sort of it brings up like Chico's theory about theme songs. You listen to the theme song and it paints a pretty decent picture as to what's going on. Not necessarily for a game show per se, but it gives you the gist of what's happening. Roll the dice, it's paradise. And if you fail, you go to jail. Yeah, it describes Monopoly in a beautiful way.
It sure does.
So, yeah. Too bad the show isn't as good as the theme. You're absolutely right about that.
There's a rule in game shows. The rule is...
You shouldn't need to have a complex flowchart as the rules to a game show.
Right. If you can't explain the premise in one word, in one sentence, it's too complex.
And Monopoly, just at its core, is complex to begin with. So,
and not to mention, Monopoly is a game where a lot of the times you make up your own rules, like money on free parking, certain rules. I mean, some of them are not official Hasbro's or Parker Brothers sanctioned rules, but
yeah,
those are like the rules in your home.
Well, they sort of did that with Monopoly here. They did a little bit of they took some artistic license, if you will.
They took some of the more popular house rules and adapted them for this show.
Well, before we get to the whole rules of how to play the game, this originally was supposed to be a syndicated show. It was announced in November of 1989 that Peter Tamarkin was going to host it. And the pilot to the show is on YouTube. It might take a little bit of searching, but you can find it. And the pilots, the show isn't much different than the pilot, but there's a couple of differences. Peter Tamarkin, as we said, was the host of the pilot, but also, as we mentioned in the Star Wars Holiday Special, Patty Maloney played Rich Uncle Pennybags and actually ran around the board. Rich Uncle Pennybags was like a human marker showing what space was landed on, which was a little surreal, a little useless. And there's a reason why Rich Uncle Pennybags didn't make the final show.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a third wheel.
You couldn't get an old man in a monocle for this show.
Yeah, there's another good point. There's plenty of old people in Hollywood. You know, you could have easily gotten somebody like Billy Barty.
You could have gotten Emile Arturi to be Rich Uncle Pennybags.
No. You didn't hear me. Billy Barty.
Oh, yeah. We could have gotten Billy Barty. That would have been terrific.
Absolutely. Well, Billy Barty may have been too big of a name.
He could have had another dwarf and a magician. Well, Billy Barty was coming right off of UHF.
There was no Rich Uncle Pennybags in the show that made it to air. And also, there was no Peter Tamarkin.
Right.
We ended up with Mike Riley. And you're saying to yourself, who is Mike Riley?
Who is Mike Riley?
That's great timing. Believe it or not, Mike Riley was a contestant on the pilot. He also was a contestant on Jeopardy. So Merv knew of him. And if you know Merv likes taking chances on unknown people as hosts. Some work, like that Sajak guy.
Or Ryan Seacrest on Click.
And Ryan Seacrest. And Chuck Woolery. And Art Fleming. And then sometimes they just don't work. Like Ty Treadway.
Mm-hmm.
Rolf Benerska. The Amazing Jonathan. And you can add Mike Riley to that list. Oh, he was a bad host. So the game itself, you had three players, and this was sort of a word game. It was maybe in the same vein as the crossword clues category on Jeopardy. Maybe also a little bit like Merv Griffin's crosswords. Oh, by the way, future entry, Merv Griffin's crosswords. But it was that type of game where, yeah, you had a crossword type of clue, and each Monopoly, each of the eight different Monopolies on the board, each of those properties, the clue associated with them started with the same letter. So if you had Baltic and Mediterranean, maybe the letter in common was L. And then the whole idea is people won the Monopolies by basically, let's say, getting a majority of the questions right. If somebody got all the questions right in the number of properties that are in that Monopoly, like if they got both questions in a two-property Monopoly or got all three in a three-property Monopoly, they automatically got the Monopoly. But if they didn't sweep it, it got a little more complex. It's kind of easy with the two-property Monopolies. Basically, the two people that got the questions right went head-to-head, and whoever got the question right gained control of that Monopoly. In a three-person situation, though, if one person got two of the properties and one person got another one, the person that had two properties only had to answer one question correctly to get that Monopoly, while the person who had one property had to answer two correctly before the other person answered one correctly in order to get the Monopoly. See, I told you, you need like a complex flow chart just to get through this. And on top of all this, you had all the rent values from the board game Monopoly. So Mediterranean was worth $60, and then you had Baltic would have been, I believe, $80 if I remember my game correctly. And the property values around the board increased until you got to Boardwalk, which was $400. And if you answered correctly, that value was taken away from your score. But also another thing, and this happened a few times, I remember this happening. If nobody answered correctly, another clue was played with the same first letter as the answer, but the value of the property was cut in half. And I wonder if that would go on if they missed that, then would it be cut in half again? And I mean, it seems really crazy because, you know, you'd go from, say, $60 for Mediterranean. If nobody gets it right twice, you're playing for $15. Who cares about $15? I'm sorry. Uh-huh. Even in 1990, as a 15-year-old, I didn't care about $15.
So quote Mike Francesa, who cares?
Who cares?
820, here's the McMahon.
And then after all eight Monopolies were played out like that, when all eight Monopolies were owned by the players, then we had a commercial break and the players used their money to build houses and hotels on their properties, not unlike the game itself. Houses were $50 a piece. And they had to be built evenly on the Monopoly, and hotels were $250. And again, had to be built evenly. So the strategy basically tells you, buy all your houses on the most expensive Monopolies you can, and then fill houses in on the other Monopoly. So in the second round, we played Monopoly, sort of like Monopoly that you play at home. There was a dice pit. It was a circular dice pit, not unlike the rectangular one from High Rollers. The dice were rolled, and everybody more or less used the same piece. It was a light that went around the board, and so the light would move however many spaces that the dice roll was. And Charlie O'Donnell mentioned the value for the question, and then Mike Riley read a question to the person who owned it. The person that owned it had first crack at winning this money. And if he got it wrong, he didn't lose any money. If he got it right, he got the value of the money added to a score. But if he got it wrong, he didn't lose money. But either other opponents could buzz in to answer and earn that money. But they had the risk of losing money if they were incorrect. Like I said, giant flowchart. This is a mess of a game. But there were also some other spaces on the board. Obviously, it isn't just properties. There were utilities, the electric company and waterworks, and a question was asked, and it was worth 100 times the number rolled on the dice. So it could be 200, it could be 1,200. That's not bad. 1,200 is better than most of the spaces on the board of hotels.
Right.
Now, railroads is where it gets very interesting. So if the light landed on one of the railroads or the space, the game piece, or the action moved to one of the railroads, one of the players got a chance to ride that railroad and initiate a hostile takeover. So a toss-up question was asked, and the first player that answered the clue correctly could choose one of the opponent's monopolies to take over. So this is a game changer now. So what happened is, once the monopoly is chosen, the light moved to the first square in that monopoly, and the person who won the toss-up question for the railroad, they got to play however many questions there were, or up to however many questions there were, in that property. So if they were going for Boardwalk and Park Place, they'd only have to answer two questions, but almost everything else on the board, minus the first monopoly, they'd answer three. So if that person got three questions right in a row without missing any, that person got control of the monopoly. And its entire combined value of the properties and the houses and hotels that were built on the monopoly went into that person's bank. So this could be a huge game changer when you're talking about the two hotels on Boardwalk and Park Place, and then the $750 rent on those two properties. So that would be $1,250 right there, but also that would be $1,250 taken away from the person who owned those two properties. So this, again, you need a giant flow chart here. It's very wacky. And then if you had a wrong answer for the takeover attempt, the person that missed had to pay the corresponding rent to the owner of the monopoly based on where the light indicator was on the monopoly. So if the person missed the first question, they'd pay the rent and whatever the hotels, the cost, including hotels or houses, for that first property, or the second or the third. So there is a little growth in risk, since obviously the prices in the monopolies, of the properties in the monopolies, does go up over time, or as you go down the path, the road. And then chance and community chest were just cards, just like the board game, that gave you some special instructions. You know, collect $10 for winning the beauty pageant, or, you know, pay $100 for every hotel you have, or every house, and $500 for every hotel. Or I'm making these up, but it's similar to what you actually see in the board game, or everybody go to go, or everybody go to jail, or everybody, you know, go to Indiana Avenue, what have you. And then the tax spaces, they were played just like the board game, more or less. Luxury tax took away $75 from everybody, and income tax took 10% away. It wasn't 10% or $200. It was a flat 10%. And then here's one of the home rules that Greg sort of talked about earlier, free parking. A question was asked, and the first player to answer correctly won $500 and all the money collected in taxes and fines since the last time free parking was correctly answered. So that could be a big game changer, depending on how much taxes were taken away if you land on income tax once or twice. And then go to jail, you go to jail, everybody lost $250. So, yeah, do you wonder why this didn't last more than 12 episodes?
Because I need a PowerPoint to explain the whole thing.
Yeah, you need a master's degree to explain this. And we're not even done yet, because after the round two was done, then we went to a commercial or to a little break, and they added all the properties and the rents back into the respective owners' banks. So Yeah, I mean, they're just throwing numbers all over the place. It's almost like, you, as a home viewer, you've got to say, okay, we trust you that you know what you're doing. We have no idea what the heck's going on. You're just throwing numbers out left, right, here, and there. It's still confusing. 30 years later, it's just mind-boggling how...
Yeah.
I mean, I understand you want to make a game show on a popular property, and Monopoly's as big as you get, but geez, look at other board games that have been done in the past and how much more simplified they were. Whether you're talking about
Scrabble,
Trivial Pursuit, even, and I know people don't like this, Boggle, the Family Channel ran back in the mid-90s. Not terribly difficult. Even if you did it sort of like what Family Game Night did on the Hub / Discovery Kids. I mean, that's a little different. That's a lot more fun. It doesn't have a laundry list of rules that you need to follow. And even if you want to keep it in the Monopoly name, what about Monopoly Millionaires Club? I know it's a lottery show, but at least that was very simple to follow.
Yeah, and it had Billy Gardell.
Yeah, it had Billy Gardell too, which is an added bonus, absolutely. So now, after all that stuff was done, and somehow they got all that done in 20-some minutes, including commercial time, you went to the bonus round. And the bonus round was nice and simple. Finally, something simple in this game.
This is probably the best part of the show, the bonus.
This is the only part of the show that's good because the rest is just such, cockamamie.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
All you have to do is go, and again, it's so simple and so easy and so enjoyable that Monopoly Millionaires Club actually did the same thing for its bonus round.
More or less, some slight differences, but not too many. So the winner of the day, they had to make one revolution around the board in 5 turns while staying out of jail. Now, there's one caveat. They didn't just roll the dice 5 times, and if the rolls ended up more than 40, yay, you won. No. The champion, the winner of the day, had to choose 4 spaces on the board, one each on the second row and the third row, and 2 on the fourth row, the home stretches you're going to go to what would be the victory space, essentially. And all those spaces became go to jail. You hit go to jail, game over. So you earned $100 for each space you moved on the board. And if you got around the board without going to jail and without running out of rules, you won $25,000.
But if you landed on go, you won $50,000.
Which never happened on the show.
No,
nobody won $50,000 on the show. It sounds nice, but again, it's just pie in the sky. So, if you go around the board and at least reach go, if you pass it, you win $25,000. If you hit it on the nose, you win $50,000. If you go to jail, you won $100 for each space that you passed during your gameplay. And that was Monopoly.
Whew.
That took forever.
No, I'm not going to draw out the rules. I can only imagine the contestant rules. Oh, my gosh. I mean, I've seen rules for Jeopardy. I've seen rules for Millionaire. Chico's seen rules for the number of shows, Jeopardy, and other shows that he's been on.
Let's Ask America.
Well, Let's Ask America. But I'm sure you've done other shows, too. I'm sure you tried out for Millionaire at some point.
Yeah.
Maybe, okay. And rules aren't supposed to be that thick. I mean, even Millionaire, I think the rules were maybe about 15, 20 pages long. A lot of legalese. But we know what the gist of Millionaire is. Question, 4 answers, 1's right. Get it right, you move on. Get it wrong, you fall down to the safety barrier. I mean, I can imagine this being like a 50 or 60 page rule book, and that's just insane.
Yeah, it was just, you know, this, and the thing of it is, this could have, was there any saving this show?
No, I really think this is a burn off. I think it was something that ABC or Merv Griffin said, hey, we've got to pair a show with Super Jeopardy on Saturday nights because we're not going to make Super Jeopardy an hour long. So, you know, what can we air at?
Of course, this was 30 years ago, so.
Yeah, I mean, they could have aired, say, you know, Mr. Belvedere reruns or some reruns of other shows that ABC would have been airing at the time. But, you know, they went with Monopoly, and it's Chico, I'm going to say it. I'm taking your line. Monopoly, it was a thing on TV. Super Jeopardy was too, but we like Super Jeopardy at least.
Yeah, we love Super Jeopardy.
Super Jeopardy was legendary.
I like Jeopardy with four players, dang it.
Oh, and I should also add, there was an international version of Monopoly. Not even joking.
There was. I've got the. It was broadcast on S4C in the UK, hosted by Derek Brown, and it was Welsh. Because that's
a Welsh version in 1992, and now it just makes me wonder. You know, you've got these crazy rules, and now you're talking Welsh. The place names that are Welsh. What? Yeah, I mean, have you ever seen any of these place names in Welsh?
You imagine if there was a Swedish version of Monopoly?
Oh God. I am looking for information on the S4C Monopoly. I don't think it exists outside of the outside of Truth by Consensus Wikipedia. Oh wait, our friends at UK Game Shows. Hi, UK Game Shows. Okay, so it was essentially the same, but here's the thing. The properties were either British cities or world cities, depending on whatever season was playing. They aired two seasons of this show.
I was just going to say, they aired two seasons of this show. And I'm really surprised that they didn't use, like, Mayfair and stuff like that.
And again, aside from that, it is exactly like the show we got.
We apologize, Wales.
Yeah, we're sorry.
Well, that was Saturday night in summer of 1990.
While you were watching ABC anxiously awaiting possibly who might have killed Laura Palmer, you had Jeopardy, and you had Monopoly on Saturday nights during the summer of 1990.
And you know what killed Laura Palmer?
Watching Monopoly.
Yeah, I think she was the first of many victims, yes.
That's how Bob killed her. She beat her watching Monopoly.
Oh, God. I need some pie and coffee after that. Well,
I'm going to go play some slot machines. I hope you don't mind.
Okay, well. Oh, jeez. Well, Super Jeopardy and Monopoly. One was a challenging bust-your-brain quizzer to find the smartest person in America. The other was challenging to figure out and busted your brain as you were watching it. Together on ABC on Saturday nights, they were a thing on TV.
Oh, those rules to Monopoly. Those are such complicated rules. It'll give you a headache. But you know what won't give you a headache, guys? The fine shows here on the Place to Be Nation Pop Feed. And we have so many great shows for you going on right now at Place to Be Nation Pop. Right now, we have the Hard Traveling Fanboys. They had their 200th episode, and after nearly 4 years, it came all down to this, as the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation, and sadly, it is also time for them to take a hard traveling hiatus, as Greg and Nick explain why they're taking an indefinite break from podcasting. Along the way, they look back at the people who made their 200 episodes an achievable number, from their favorite episodes to their favorite guests. The boys reminisce and look to the future. It's a candid discussion about the very real burnout both have felt at times during the show, and how they're planning to recharge some of their passions. On the Brother Sister Rewatch podcast, Kevin and Mary look at episodes 7 and 8 of the 5th season of The Office, Customer Survey, and Business Trip. While covering these episodes, siblings discuss Pam's art school odyssey, Jim and Dwight's great team-up, Michael's chronic loneliness, and a rare good Andy episode, and much, much more. And on the latest episode of Looking Forward, Looking Back, Andy Atherton is joined by Jennifer Smith, Tim Capel, and Miranda Burfield to review the movie releases from this past fall, which include It Chapter 2, Downton Abbey, Joker, Parasite, Doctor Sleep, The Irishman, Frozen 2, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, Jojo Rabbit, Knives Out, Midway, Bombshell, Cats, and Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. And of course, be sure to check out the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which includes a dive into topics running the gamut from the day's WWE through yesteryear, including the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Wrestling Warzone, Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jenny and the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, PTBN, NXT, and so much more. Subscribe today. And while you're at it, subscribe to Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position feed as well, as this is a new home of Geek and Sassy, Talking Pop, Freak Out, Driving, Telling Stories, and more. And on our social media pages, the greatest sitcom of all time tournament is now in its final stages. We're now in the final four. It's down to the nitty-gritty. Which show will be crowned by the Place to Be Nation as the greatest sitcom of all time? Well, you're going to have to log on to their Facebook page and check it out. But unfortunately, as I've said before, if Hello Larry isn't on the Final Four, I nothing matters. Nothing matters. I'm just going to say it right now. By the way, we've also kicked off our 2020 stretch project, determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have all year to do your research, promote matches, and build your list. Conversation rules can be found at www.facebook.com/GWCW matches or on the Pro Wrestling Only message board. And be sure not to forget to check out PlaceToBeNation.com each and every day. We have new voices and fresh takes, bringing you articles on topics in the worlds of wrestling, sports and pop culture, trending trends, SmackDown on Fox Report, This Week in the WWE by John Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, and Ben's Unpopular Opinion. And don't forget about veteran columns like Glenn Butler's weekly Walk Around the Web. And if you're doing online shopping over at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner on the right side of the Place to Be Nation homepage, or use www.placetobenation.com/Amazon. It'll take you right to Amazon and helps out PDBN at no cost to you. All right, let's get into the final topic of this week's trio of It Was a Thing on TV episodes here on PTBN Pop, as we look back in early 2000 when Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was the biggest thing on television, and the other networks decided to throw their hat into the big money quiz show ring with their own attempts to try to knock off Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Literally, it's Who Wants to Be a Millionaire knockoffs as we look at It's Your Chance of a Lifetime, Winning Lines, and 21.
Welcome to the It Was the Thing on TV podcast, episode 20, submission 075, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire Wannabes? We're going to cover three shows this episode. We're not going to spend a lot of time in each episode for obvious reasons. We don't want this show going on for 2 hours. We're going to talk about three shows who are trying to capitalize off of the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire bandwagon in 1999 and 2000. We're going to talk about It's Your Chance of a Lifetime and Winning Lines and 21. And joining me, as always, are Chico and Greg. Say hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
There you go. Good. The first show we're going to talk about today is It's Your Chance of a Lifetime. It aired on Fox for five episodes. Five big episodes between June 5th and June 10th of 2000. It's Your Chance of a Lifetime was supposedly a big international hit, and it's coming to America, and it's going to sweep America, and it swept America for all of 5 episodes. It wasn't a bad show. I don't know about you guys. It wasn't a bad show. It's just, like, nobody watched it, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just looking at the international status that they touted in the opening, Australia had a version which ran...
I believe that was the original version.
Yeah, and probably the most popular version. It ran from 1999 to 2000. It actually had the same top prize as the American version, just in Australian dollars. We'll get to that in a moment. And it ran in Germany. It actually ran for 4 years in Germany, 5 years in Hungary, 2 separate times in Indonesia, 2004 and 2008, 2 years in Italy, 2001 to 2002 in Lebanon. And actually, there's a junior version in Lebanon in 2002. And it ran in Poland from 2000 to 2002. Versions aired in Norway, France, Israel, and other countries. So it is sort of an international hit, kind of, sort of-ish.
It was international enough for government work, basically.
It is international enough to promote. Hey, it's an international hit. Okay,
It's in Australia and a bunch of other countries.
Yeah, technically, could an international hit be something that's taking place in Niagara Falls, Canada? It's international. You know, nobody may know of it outside of Niagara Falls, but it's international and it's a hit.
Yep.
Just throwing that out there. So this was trying to capitalize on Millionaire, as we said at the start of the show. It's a coattail rider, a knockoff of sorts. As we said, it aired from June 5th to June 10th, and it was actually supposed to be a weekly series after that first week, but it got the axe. After week one, it got the axe. The show was supposed to have aired Monday through Friday, the 5th through the 9th of June, but ABC decided to air a special episode of Millionaire opposite it on June 7th. And so Fox opted not to air an episode that day and delayed the remaining episodes one day each. Oh, I wonder if ABC's maneuver here actually sort of threw everything off. I love it. So, Interchance of a Lifetime was like the last of the first copycats or heirs to the throne, if you will, after Millionaire had a success in 1999. And the game really wasn't all that difficult. A single player played this game. There were a total of 10 questions. The first question was more or less like a qualifier question, where if you got it right, and it was a really simple question, you got a credit card bill taken care of. And to increase the drama or the effect, not only did the contestant have the credit card bill with them, there was a giant shredder on stage. So what would happen is if the person got the question right, Gordon Elliott, who is the host of the show, would take the credit card bill and stick it in the shredder, and you saw the shredded bill at the bottom because it was like a plexiglass or a glass bottom on the shredder. So after the initial credit card question, 9 more questions were played in the game. There were 10 categories given, and for each question, 1 category was chosen, presumably at random, and for the first question in this stack of 9, it was worth $5,000 if right. If wrong, the game's over, but the person still leaves with their credit card bill paid. Then each subsequent question after that, the player could choose to play on if they were right previously and how much of that money they want to risk. And they had to risk at least half. And again, at any time, if you missed it, you lose your wager, game's over, you walk with whatever money that you kept up to that point. But there were a number of times when people were very gutsy and said, we'll risk all of it. They got the question wrong, game over. You still walk with your credit card being paid. There were some second chances available, not unlike Lifelines and Millionaire. Yeah, every one of these shows had their own little Lifeline, but they couldn't call it a Lifeline for obvious reasons.
So the Lifelines on this show were called Second Chances, Mike.
Oh, no.
Oh, boy.
Do you think that one of the Second Chances connected your directory to St. Peter and Kyle Martin?
Hey, Chico, did you see that one coming, Chico? I absolutely didn't.
I am shocked. This is my shocked face.
We see
also future installment.
Yeah, future installment, Second Chance, not the game show, the sitcom. Thank you, Greg. There were two lifelines that were known as Second Chances, and each could only be used once. One of them turned a short answer question into a multiple choice question. They were given three multiple choice answers. And the other one allowed the player to discard the current question and replace it with one from the player's favorite category of those in play for that game. If a person reached the final three questions, they were rewarded with a last chance, which allowed that person an extra use of either of the second chances, playing the favorite category or turning an open-ended question into a three-choice, multiple-choice question. It wasn't, you know, much of a game. I mean, there wasn't much to look back upon and say, oh, this is a great game. There were a couple of contestants, though, that, well, one went on to, let's say, not necessarily bigger fame and fortune, but went on to some other game shows. That person is named Mickey Mootsie, who may ring a bell. Mickey Mootsie was on Hollywood Showdown about a year later. But also, Mickey Mootsie was a contestant on Card Sharks this past season.
Yes, she was.
And she did very well for herself on Card Sharks. But also, we had a millionaire come out of this. The top prize, as I said earlier, was the same as the Australian version, $1,280,000 plus the credit card being paid. And we had somebody who actually surpassed $1 million. We had Dr. Timothy Shea.
Yep.
He won $1,042,309. Now, again, like I said, the game, it was a good game. The one thing that really irked me after seeing just a couple of episodes, the whole credit card payment thing, that really sort of irked me because some people had a $9,000 credit card. And then some people had a $1,500 credit card. But also at the same time, what about people like me? And I'll openly admit this. I don't have any credit cards. So what do I do if I got on the show? I have no credit cards. I can't just bring my student loan bill or my mortgage bill and say, take care of it.
Yeah, I don't have a credit card either.
So yeah, I
will hit a rose on both your noses.
Well, but the thing is, where I'm getting at is it sort of limits the contestant pool because, yeah, I'm sorry, I haven't had a credit card in 20 years, and yeah, I've never had a credit card bill go above like $1,500. So, yeah, does that disqualify me from being on a show because I don't have a credit card bill? It seems stupid in that regard. But also, like I said, some credit card bills were over $9,000. There's one that I saw that was like $1,500. That's just like very bad inequity there.
Yeah.
I mean, I sort of get it. It's sort of the same thing they did with debt where, okay, we had somebody on debt that has a $7,300 debt and somebody's got a $6,500 debt and somebody's got an $8,000 debt. Yeah, we know that debts are going to be different. But the thing is, they were all in the same general range within about $1,000 of each other, maybe $1,500.
Yeah, they would average the debts to like a certain
debt. Well, for the game itself, yeah. For the game itself, for score purposes, yeah. But the thing is, at the end, when they played the final round, that was for your debt or for double your debt. So the thing is, yeah, it could have been played for, you know, $15,000, $13,000, $18,000. I mean, but here, like I said, you know, the credit card could be $9,500 or it could be $1,300. Not really equitable, to say the least. So yeah, that was It's Your Chance of a Lifetime. Not a lot to say about it. Wasn't really that great of a show. Sort of, I think there's a little bit of greed in there. You had Mark Thompson doing the announcing, and I think Mark Thompson announced everything on Fox back in 2000.
Yeah, Mark Thompson was pretty much the go-to announcer for Fox in the early 2000s. And again, you look at this, and it was just so much. There was just so much millionaire in this, and people just pretty much picked up on the fact that, hey, this is Who Wants to Be a Millionaire ripoff, and it's not even a good one.
More or less, absolutely.
If I wanted to watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, I'd watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
And gosh, that was aired often enough.
Oh yeah, it was like, what was it, 3-4 nights a week back in 2000?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that's what people were watching. They weren't watching that knockoff and the other two that we're going to talk about. I shouldn't say the other two were good games. One game I liked, one game we'll get to in a little bit. And the game we're going to talk about now is Winning Lines. I'm going to admit it. I loved Winning Lines, even though it was deeply
flawed. It had all the numbers on it. That's probably what it was.
It wasn't just the numbers. The set was, I mean, it was sort of like, in a way, like 1 versus 100, except, you know.
It was exactly 1 versus 100, only with 49 people.
Yeah, it was 49% of 1 versus 100. Absolutely.
And Winning Lines was from the same production team as Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
And stop me if you heard this one, based on a British format.
No, would never guess that.
Well, the original British game show, I believe, was a lottery game show.
A lottery game show, yes.
And it was produced by the same people who did that show. Well, them and also Stone Stanley, because, well, Stone Stanley.
And this was hosted by the legendary Dick Clark.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, this does not go, it's not one of his top games in his resume. Obviously, Pyramid is first, and then you've got the Challengers, and you've got probably the Krypton Factory even above that. Winning Lines is sort of lost in the shuffle. But,
yeah.
Oh, I loved Winning Lines. Oh, it like I said, it had its flaws. We'll get into that in a little bit. But as Chico said, there were 49 players in the game, and each one had a number from 1 to 49 in front of their podium, which was essentially their ID through the second round of the game until they got to the end game. That number was important to them. We'll get to that in a little bit. So there were 6 questions that were asked, and the answers were all numerical, and whoever among the 49 players answered first moved on to the next round, and then with the 48 people that were left, they did it again, and 47 and 46 and 45 and 44, until they had 6 people for the second round, and the 43 people who were left over, they were just sent home. Bye-bye. Thanks for playing. So, I mean, just off the top, you had pretty much a 1 in 8 chance of moving on just by pure luck. I mean, just basic statistics and probability says that. But then round 2, and this is where I have issues. You basically had to sort of protect your number. And what I mean by that is that 2-digit number that you're given between 0-1 and 4-9. Questions were read, and one of the answers was a number of the people that were left in play. So if we had, let's say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 49, you knew the answer to the question was either going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 49. And what would happen is the question would be read, and if the person who buzzed in had the number that corresponded to the right answer, they would essentially save their space. If anybody else answered with that person's number, the person with that number would be eliminated. So if the answer was 49 and the person with number 2 buzzed in said 49, the person that had number 49 would be eliminated. And you did this until there was one person left. And if nobody buzzed in on a question, Dick Clark then gave the correct answer, and the contestant with that number was eliminated. The one person who remained won $2,500, and the other five people each received $1,000. I mean, this is kind of cutthroat, but here's one of the big flaws. Just the way you look at it, if no person defends their number, you're going to go through five questions.
Yeah.
You've got six people, six numbers in play. One person's number is not going to come up at all. That person is essentially safe, if you think about it. Or at least has the best chance of winning. Let's say that, the best chance of advancing. So, yeah, I mean, if the answers are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 49, okay, maybe question 1, the answer is 1. Question 2, the answer is 2. Question 3, the answer is 3. Question 4, the answer is 4. Question 5, the answer is 5. That person who has 49, if you think about it, the only way they could lose is if they buzz in and give a wrong answer. True?
True.
Yes.
True. That's a flaw. That's a big flaw. Now, I'm just bringing it down to its core. That is a horrible flaw. If you have the one number that just by chance doesn't get called in a series of five questions, you have a huge advantage.
Basically.
Yeah, the numbers say so. But then, and this is maybe the best bonus round of the last 20 plus years.
When you think of winning lines, this is what everyone will think of in their first thought in their head was, oh my God, that bonus game was amazing.
The bonus game, like, overshadows everything else. The Wonderwall.
Yep.
O-M-G. I'm sorry. I'm going to say that. O-M-G. I don't care if I sound like a teenager. It was amazing. And to think this came from Stone Stanley, the people who brought you Running Through the Fun House and Running Through the Hidden Temple.
So, how is the Wonderwall played, you're probably wondering?
I'm wondering just that.
Well, you have a triple screen of 49 correct answers, and you have 15 seconds to study them. And then you're drilled questions for 3 minutes, I believe. If you answer 20 of them correctly, giving the number and the answer, you win $1 million.
So simple.
But here's the thing. You are given 3 strikes. If you get the question wrong, that's a strike. You get 3 strikes, you're done. And you lose everything. I believe you get two pit stops where you're allowed to stay the board for another 15 seconds.
Right. We also should add that each of the answers on the board was numbered. So you had a number for each answer, you know, 1, Poughkeepsie, 2, St. Louis, 3, Pope John Paul II, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you actually did have to answer in that way. You had to say 3, Pope John Paul II. And the money went up with the number of correct answers. This is a long way, so we're going to go through the entire ladder. There's actually, there are 20 different spots on this ladder, so if you got 0 or 1 correct answer, you won $2,500. Yeah. 2 got you $5,000, 3 got you $7,500, 4 got you $10,000, then $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 for 15 correct answers. 200,000, 300,000, 400, 500, and then all 20 got you $1 million. And the premiere episode had somebody oh so close to the million.
Oh.
Catherine Rahm. I don't know if you remember her. Catherine Rahm.
I do remember her.
And she breezed through this game. And she was down to, she was at the 19 correct answers. $500,000 in her pocket, And the time was counting down. She maybe had 10 seconds left, maybe a little bit longer. And she ultimately bailed, left with $500,000. But there's one big thing. She still had a pit pass to use, a pit stop. She still had a pit stop to use.
Uh-huh.
So she could have used the pit stop, taken the 15-second timeout, looked for that one answer, won the million.
Wow.
But, yeah, I mean, I loved everything about this game, minus the flawed second round. But the Wonderwall, like I said, that might be the best bonus round we've had in the last 20 years or 20-plus years at this point. It was amazing. And you had Dick Clark ring it all. And Dick Clark is a consummate pro. I mean, it was a great host. It was a decent show. But not unlike Monopoly and Super Jeopardy that we talked about the previous episode, it was buried on Saturday night. It was a Saturday night at 8 o'clock. I don't know if it would have done any better in any other time slot, but it's sad that this show lasted only from January 8th of 2000 to February 18th of 2000. Only 10 episodes were recorded, and actually one of them went unaired, so only 9 shows aired.
Yeah.
But that's winning lines. Now, do you guys have anything to add about winning lines?
Well, did you mention the bailouts?
You are allowed, as Chico said, with 3 wrong answers, the game's over. You lose everything you had earned up to that point, minus the $2,500. When you got down to 2 strikes, or if you got to 15 seconds left in the game, you could bail out and leave with the money that you earned, which Catherine Rahm did, as we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Winning lines, I thought it was a very good concept for a game show. I think out of all the 3 other shows that came out of the wake of Millionaire, between Greed, Winning Lines, and 21, I personally like Greed a lot. But I think as far as presentation and everything goes, this was the best, especially with the bonus game.
I actually would agree with you. Greed was a little too cutthroat for me. And like I said, you had Dick Clark. The game, I just love the concept of the game outside of its flaws. And the Wonderwall is just absolutely amazing. But you talked about 21. I think that's where we're going to go next, 21.
Yeah. So 21 was a revival of the infamous game show of the same name from back in the late 50s.
Yes, and if you recall, there was an attempt by Barry Enright in the 1980s to try to revive 21.
And yeah. That was bad.
Yes.
It was.
That was with Jim Lang wearing no glasses.
And with what would turn out to be the number jumbler from Break the Bank in 1985.
Ugh.
That's one way of saying it. Ugh. Well, 21, as you may remember, if you've seen the movie Quiz Show, it was maybe the most popular rigged show back in the 50s. It was the one where Charles Van Doren was on for ages and Herb Stempel was given the answers and he didn't want to throw his game. And we all know the story if you've seen Quiz Show. When 21 first aired back in the 50s, there was no rigging going on, if you remember Quiz Show and the whole scandal regarding quiz shows. 21 was dry, boring, bland. So how did they decide to make it more interesting? Let's rig the shows.
Yeah, if you've seen the American Experience from PBS on the Quiz Show channel, they show clips from like one of the early episodes of 21, and everyone's getting wrong answers left and right.
It's boring as all get out. So how do they make the show more exciting? Let's rig it. And, oh, that seemed really good until you had Herb Stempel, who was playing the game straight, and oh, well, you know, they gave me these answers, and, well, I knew the right answer to this, but they wanted me to throw the game because Charles Van Doren was a national hero, and he had won, you know, well over $100,000 at the time, and he was a minor celebrity in his own right at the time.
He was on the Today Show.
He was on the Today Show, absolutely. That's what I was just going to say. So, you know, I can't take down this pretty boy who went to, I believe, Harvard, one of the Ivy League schools. I believe he was a doctorate in some of some sort. So, yeah, you've got the hero in Charles Van Doren, who's, you know, who's being fed everything. And then you've got Herb Stemple, who's like the antithesis, the guy who's really, you know, he did not look good, sort of geeky in a way. And he was playing the game straight. And, yeah, then, you know, this is when all the congressional hearings came about for the game show rigging. And when Millionaire had its success, what was NBC's first thought as to how to combat it? Hey, let's revive 21, the boring as heck show when it wasn't rigged from 45 years ago at that point, almost 45 years ago. And let's, you know, throw tons of money at it. And the problem is the game was not just boring, but pretty easy. I mean, everything was multiple choice or true false. And I don't know, you just couldn't fall in love with the contestants. And I shouldn't say fall in love, but it was hard to root for somebody, maybe in the way that, you know, you had Charles Van Doren back in the day.
Yeah.
So the game 21 is just, I mean, as simple as the game back in the 50s. You had to get 21 points exactly, and you were given a category, and you could take any number of points from 1 to 11, and you were given a multiple choice question. And the more points, obviously, the harder the difficulty. If the question was worth 6 or less points, you were given a multiple choice question with 3 possible answers. If it was worth 7 through 10 points, you had 4 choices to pick from. And then for 10-point questions, none of the above was an option. And then questions worth 11 points had 2 correct answers out of 5, and you had to get both answers correct. Incorrect answers didn't take points away from the contestant's score like they did back in the 50s. And just like in the 50s, after 2 rounds, one person could declare to end the game if they thought they were in the lead. And if nobody wanted to take that chance, they continued playing on. Until, again, either somebody said, I want to stop the game, or somebody got 21 points. There were also strikes. If you got an incorrect response, you got a strike, and just like everything in life, 3 strikes and you're out.
Yeah, but there was another twist.
But there was another twist. Yes, I was just going to add. For 11-point questions, you still got a strike for an incorrect response. You didn't get 2 strikes, but you still got one, even if you got one of the correct answers and the other one was incorrect. But yeah, there was a twist, Brother Chico.
Yes, you see, at any point, you could call on a second chance. And it wasn't 2 shots for the correct answer. No. They brought in a loved one, and you guys talked it out to see if you could suss out the answer. And if you get it right, you win the points. If not, you get 2 strikes.
Yeah. Double the help, but also double the risk.
Yep.
So that adds some more suspense to the show.
And then also, you can only use the...
Right.
Yeah.
Obviously. You know what I wish? You know what I would say? I'm gonna call on my second chance. I'm going to call on St. Peter to help me.
Gosh.
That's right, I'm going to keep making more references to the second chance, damn it.
If you had a second chance. No. That's another episode later this year. So this game, I don't know, even know if they know what they're doing, because the price structure changed very shortly into the game. Originally, the first game was worth $100,000. The second game was worth $200,000. The third was worth $300,000. The fourth was worth $400,000. So that would be $1 million. And then if that person won a fifth game, it would go back to $100,000. And it would just repeat. But then, maybe in a cost-cutting move, in February of 2000, game one was worth only $25,000. Game two was worth $50,000. Game three was worth $100,000. Game four was worth $250,000. Game five was worth $500,000. Game six was worth $750,000. And then game seven was worth $1 million. I almost feel like I should have my pinky finger up to my mouth. $1 million.
Well, it was 2000. It was very timely for the Dr. Evil reference back then.
Well, it would have been, yeah. And anybody who lost received $1,000 in consolation money. But then there was a bonus round added.
Yes, the perfect 21 bonus round.
Yeah. This looks really lame in comparison when you're talking about winning $400,000 in a game. People could win up to $210,000.
Uh-huh.
There were six true-false questions. The first one was worth $10,000. The second was worth an additional $20,000. The third was worth an additional $30,000. All the way up to the sixth question worth an additional $60,000. $210,000. Perfect 21. 21 times 10,000 is 210,000. Isn't that lovely how math works out? Now, here's the catch. If you can stop at any time. So if you wanted to take your $30,000 or $60,000 and run, not a problem. But if you played on and you got the question wrong, you went down to zero. And really, when we talk about the big numbers starting at question four, you've got $60,000 in your hand. Do you really want to risk $60,000 to win $40,000 more on a 50-50 coin toss? Not necessarily a coin toss, an educated guess, but still, it's not a wise decision at that point. But also, again, when you're throwing out millions and millions of dollars and then your bonus round, oh, you won $30,000. Who cares? That's like butt-wiping money when you've won over $1 million at that point.
Yeah.
I would. And I've already won $1 million. Like, why do I need to risk it? If I were given $30,000, I'm like, okay, that's cool. Never $30,000. I don't need to play this game anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would just be like, okay, I'll take the $30,000 and move on, because the next game for me could be worth $500,000 or $750,000. I really don't care about the $30,000. I care about the $750,000.
So basically the bonus game in 21 is irrelevant.
I would say it's so. Just
there to be there.
Well, I would say after the first win, yeah, I mean, if you win $100,000, you know, padding it with another $30,000 isn't a bad thing. But the thing is, when you've already won $1.5 million, who cares about winning another $30,000 or $60,000 at that point? I mean, it's obviously a good thing, but, you know, you're talking about such a small number in comparison to the bigger picture. The one thing that this version had, which I don't think many shows, if any shows, have done since then, is that there was a live band, at least in the early episodes. And that was really a cool touch.
It was also a throwback to the original version of 21, which had, I believe, a live orchestra.
Yeah, I think everything back in the 50s pretty much had live music.
Everything back. I think the last game show to have a live musical backing was Let's Make a Deal in the 70s.
Oh, and, no, they need that too. No, wait.
That's an exception because it kind of needed the orchestra.
you kind of need the orchestra for needing that tune.
True. Yeah. And how dare we forget future installment, Face the Music.
Well, you kind of needed the orchestra for Face the Music as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just, it was everything about 21 was sort of modern day retro, from the staging, which was, and the plants and everything, to the orchestra in the rafters, and then you had, of course, you had the TV screens for the scores instead of the egg crates.
And you had the isolation booth, so I mean, it was a flashback to the 50s. And there were some big winners. Raheem Oberholzer was the biggest winner under the first payoff structure. He won $1,120,000, winning four games. And then a name that both me and Chico know pretty well, Dave Legler, won under the second payoff structure. He won six games and $1,765,000. And even now, 20 years later, he's still the eighth highest winner from an American TV game show. But there's more, gentlemen.
Oh, more? Yes. We haven't even mentioned who hosted the show.
Oh, boy.
Oh, do we want to mention who hosted the show? Yeah,
yes,
well, we have
we
to.
Should.
Yes, we do.
We
have to.
All right. I'll give you one hint. And we're going to play a clip. Get ready.
When it comes to one-year-old Kalise, Jose, you are not.
That's right, folks. Maury freaking Povich was the host of 21.
Not that he necessarily did a bad job. He didn't do a great job. He was sort of robotic.
Yep. He always said, hey, you know what? I am not a game show host. I am a journalist. Maury Povich played this show as the anti-game show host.
He was very decent, I have to say.
He did his job well. He was a conduit. He knew what to do, and he did it. And that is to be applauded.
He was acceptable, yes. But, gentlemen, there's even more to the story.
What?
Oh. What?
No, this isn't an O. I tried out for 21 back in 1999.
Oh, did you?
I did. Uh-huh. There were tryouts being done in Chicago, and this was, I believe, either Thanksgiving weekend or the weekend after Thanksgiving of 1999, and I drove to Chicago. It was about a 5.5-6 hour drive, and they did a huge audition in one of the downtown hotels. And there had to have been hundreds, if not maybe over 1,000 people there. And it took some time to obviously get through that many people. And that was with, I want to say there had to be at least 6, maybe 8 contestant coordinators taking 2 people at a time. It still took like 4 hours to get through everybody. And the game, it was still in flux at that point. Now, when we tried out, all they did was we did the usual boilerplate contestant stuff. We gave our personal information, what we do for a living, stuff like that. But then the mock game itself, it was there were no isolation booths, obviously.
Uh-huh.
And you played 2 questions, only 2 questions. And they wanted to see how you'd play the 2 questions. And then they sent you on your merry way after you played the 2 questions. And I remember in my questions, I got both of them right. Oh, and there were no multiple choice answers. It was straightforward, open answer. So I had 2 questions, got both of mine right. I think I had scored 17 points maybe, or maybe 16. My opponent either had like 17 or 18. He beat me by like 1 or 2 points. And that was it. Okay, thank you. Yeah, have a good day. Drive safely. And obviously nothing ever came of that. But they did tell us what the rules were at that point. Now, remember that this was in Thanksgiving, late November, early December of 1999. the show went to air in January of 2000, so a month later. The original rules that they gave us was that each point was worth, if I remember correctly, $10,000. So if you won the game, you won $210,000. I don't remember there being a bonus game, so that may have just been tacked on at the end. But the big thing is, just like the original 21, oh no, was it 10,000? It might have been something even bigger. It might have been 20,000 or 50,000, or I'm not even joking, $100,000 maybe? It might have been like $100,000. I'm not even joking, because I remember them telling us that, yeah, if you lose a game, you could literally lose millions. You could lose everything. Because they did go by the old rules in the 50s, where if you got a question wrong, you lost points. So if you ended up losing 21 to nothing, you'd lose 21 times whatever that point was worth. So if we're talking like $100,000 a point, and you earn the $100,000 per point difference, you know, you could win $2.1 million while your opponent loses $2.1 million, and they might only have, say, $1.4 million. Yeah, that's what it was. I knew $10,000 sounded too low, because they did mention, you know, just like you could win or lose a life-changing amount of money in one game. That might have made the game more interesting, but then you're just like throwing around absolutely insanely humongous numbers.
Yeah.
I understand if, you know, the difference in a game is, say, 4 points, 400,000. But if you get to a situation where, you know, one person wins 21-0, 21-0, that's $4.2 million. I'm sure NBC's not going to like that.
No.
Well, if this was the Jeff Zucker era, I'm sure they would have just gone ahead and said, oh, F it.
So, yeah, that was the way the game was, and that really was intriguing when they told us this. It's like $100,000 per point differential? I mean, that's an amazing amount of money. But then they changed it to this, and this just... It seems so boilerplate. I mean, if you look at Millionaire had this money ladder... And what was the prize structure in 21 other than just a little money ladder? A money ladder that repeats.
It just sucked all the life out of it. And the thing of it is, it was still a top 20 show back when it was airing.
Yeah. That's nuts.
Yeah. I mean, Greed had good ratings too. And I mean, even for, I want to say 10 to 15 years after it, no show in that Friday 9 o'clock time slot ever did as well as Greed did.
I don't think until Fringe was a hit on Friday nights, they had a show that was as big as Greed.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, this could have been, like, amazingly huge money amounts flying everywhere. You know, hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars changing hands in the course of one game, which I think would be a real draw. But then they went this other route, and it's like... Fred Silverman, you screwed up again.
Yeah.
Hey, why not? Fred Silverman screwed up in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. He screwed up in the 2000s as well. What decade didn't Fred Silverman screw up in?
2010s.
He probably found a way to screw up something last decade. Well, he couldn't have screwed up anything in the 2020s. We're only 4 days into it. Yay, Fred Silverman, you haven't screwed up anything in the 2020s yet.
Don't worry, Fred Silverman. I'm sure Jeff Zucker is going to take your title as the biggest screw-up on television in decades soon enough.
And yet, Jeff Zucker still has a job.
So, yeah, it's amazing that, you know, what could have happened and what really would have probably been a better game.
It would have been a better game because there would have been a sort of there would have been a risk assessment element. It would have been a meta game. I don't know why they changed format aside from, hey, let's throw money at the problem and see if we can knock this millionaire gauntlet out.
And again, the change was done weeks before the first taping. Weeks. I mean, if you look at it, the 2000 version premiered January 9th of 2000. So we're talking literally just over a month after my audition. And I'm sure, and the show wasn't live. It may have been delayed by a day or two, but it wasn't like it recorded like the day after the Chicago auditions were done. But yeah, it's just the possibilities are endless, and we ended up with this. Shrug the shoulders. That's just my reaction. I mean, it could have been really, really well done. Maybe boring again. Well, I understand the boring part. I mean, if we're using the same rules as the 50s before it was rigged, yeah, that would be boring. But also at the same time, you've got hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, at risk every time you play the game, or millions of dollars at risk potentially.
They're using that as it's like this is basically the $1 million thing. Was basically what the jiggle factor was in the 70s. It's like, let's throw money at the problem and see if we can solve it. But here's the thing. More money does not equal good gameplay. More money is not a substitute for good gameplay. Jiggle is not a suitable substitute for plot development.
Well, and also, remember that at that time in 2000... every network was trying to outdo the other one by having the next big winner. So you had Millionaire. Millionaire gave its first million away to John Carpenter. Then, you know, the other network, they had to give more away. We talked about Raheem Oberholzer. He won $1.1 million, $1.12 million. We had Dave Legler win $1.765 million. And then the stakes grew and grew and grew. And then what happened with Millionaire? You had Kevin Olmsted winning $2.1 million, and you had Ed Tutant winning $1.7 million. It was always a constant competition to outdo the other networks and claim they had the biggest money winner of all time.
Yeah,
and I mean, it even continued with NBC until Million Second Quiz. Is that a submission? If not, that should
you
be.
Know, it should be.
And besides, and the thing of it is, if you think it ended with these shows,
no,
it did not, because what happened in the summer of 2000?
Survivor, Big Brother, and then the next year you had The Amazing Race
and Fear Factor and The Weakest Link.
Yeah, but those shows weren't trying to outdo the other networks saying, hey, we gave away $2.5 million or $2.8 million or $3 million. They just had $1 million as the main prize for Amazing Race and Survivor and $500,000 for Big Brother. And, I mean, even if you look at Weakest Link, I don't think anybody ever won more than about $150,000 on Weakest Link.
Right.
And Fear Factor was $50,000. So it wasn't necessarily trying to get a big money winner out of those. It was more or less like the expansion of the entire reality/quasi-game show genre.
And those games were not necessarily richer, but they were better done, better executed, had better development. Like I said, Jiggle is not a substitute for plot development. And we remember those games more than we did the three that we mentioned on this episode.
And really, you have a great point there. When talking about Survivor, the whole plotting, the trying to survive on an island for 42 days, Amazing Race was learning so much about the different cultures and just the different areas. I mean, they went to some amazing parts of the world. Each of them had their own different draw in different ways, but by no means were they trying to ever say, hey, we're the game or the TV show that gave away $8.7 million to Joe Schmo.
Spoilers.
Another submission. Joe Schmo.
What is going on?
What is going on? Well, that's our look at three of the sort of wannabes to the Millionaire Throne from 2000.
Yep. Each one had their own strengths. Each one had a boatload of weaknesses, but ultimately they could have been really good, but ultimately they were just a thing on TV.
They were just things on TV, absolutely. Well, as always, we're at www.itwasathingontv.com. And Greg has some news for us about something that we were added to just within the last couple of days. Greg, please tell the listeners what happened.
We are now officially syndicated on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. Now, for those of you who don't know about Place to Be Nation, it's on the website placetobenation.com. And it's basically a hub for your pop culture world. It's, in fact, the slogan is the only place to be in your pop culture world. And they have a lot of articles about stuff like wrestling, stuff like comics, stuff like television. And they have a bunch of podcasts. They have a wrestling feed podcast. In fact, Mike, they have a wrestling-themed game show. And do you want to know what the title of the wrestling themed game show is?
What is it?
Body Pressure Luck.
Oh, jeez. Oh, brother.
I'm going to answer some tough questions, brother. I'm going to avoid the whammies. But we're also on the Place to Be Nation pop feed. So right now, the first episode, as we're recording this, the much famous, Mike, the preview episode is
the pilot.
So Match Game Hollywood Squares Hour, which is episode one, should be coming up. And so I talked to the guy who runs the feed, Todd. Very nice guy, by the way. He's going to try to get all the episodes up and try to slowly but surely get us up to date, which might take a while since we're currently on episode 20. But I'm gonna find a way to help get us up to date quickly. So you can find Place to Be Nation at the following. You can visit them at their website at placetobenation.com, on Twitter at place2benation, or on Facebook at facebook.com/placetobenation.
If that was any more complicated, Peter Tsumarkin would be hosting a pilot for it. and the lady from the Star Wars holiday special would be walking around Lumpy. The board. We played Lumpy, yes. That's called a callback, kids.
So yeah, we're very proud to be part of the Place to Be Nation network. Please visit them, especially if you're into wrestling. They've got a lot of wrestling podcasts. As always, you know, please like and subscribe us, rate and review us, do all that good stuff, please, to help us. We thank you in advance for any assistance and support you provide us by doing that. So next week, we sort of veer out into the unusual. Not doing game shows next week. Sorry to disappoint those of you who like the game show episodes. We're getting into something which is near and dear to Greg and Chico's hearts.
It is.
And also we're going to get to something that I think might be near and dear to my heart. So there's a little bit for each of the three of us.
Hold up. One segment that's near and dear to me and Chico's heart was going to have something for you in it, Mike. Because there's someone involved that's near and dear to your heart that's in it.
Oh, really? Okay, that's news to me. We'll take a look at that next week, then.
So something for everybody next week. First is, I'm not going to tell you what it is first, but I will say the budget was heavily cut on this one. And what I mean heavily, heavily.
Snicker, snicker.
I'll give you a hint. It's somewhere around the range of $2.
Give or take. Yes, we're talking about a $2.02 show.
And the second one is something that is, again, we put this on this particular week because of what happened
this week in that something, well, a favorite of, if not Mike's, and certainly Greg and mine's returned. And by the way, Greg, that wham moment on at the end of Wednesday's episode.
Oh, yeah. What an amazing twist. What an amazing twist.
What an amazing twist indeed. Of course, we won't be talking about that. We'll be talking about something else. So be on the lookout for that. Good stuff.
You know, it's like Greg and Chico are like Furbies talking their own little language right now. I have no idea what they're talking about.
How's that different from any other day?
I don't understand what you guys are talking about now. So next week, we have two more great episodes coming your way. Until then, for Chico and for Greg, I'm Mike. Thank you, as always, for listening. Bye-bye.
And don't eat pears.
Winning line.
Hold up.
Oh, no.
It's your chance of a lifetime.
Wow. Oh my gosh, did we really do that?